Alive and Kicking
with Claire McKenna.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
This is News Talk.
Yes, this is Alive and Kicking, News Talk's health and wellness show. I'm Claire McKenna, and you can contact the show by emailing aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up, how to turn a negative self-image around with ex-Mountjoy inmate Gary Cunningham, Lucy Wolfe on how she ended up as a baby sleep guru, and how can you avoid the flu? So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, it was a good one, actually. I was in Galway for the Galway Bay 10K. Now, plenty of people were running longer than that, but that was my chosen destination. And it was great practice for the Great Pink Run, which is now 2 weeks away. It was a very wet and wild day in Salt Hill, I'd have to say, but I've decided I would actually sooner run in that than the hot sun. And I was staying in a hotel in Galway City. And the joy of the bath that I had when I made it back to that room, freezing cold and soaking wet, I don't think you can rival it. I was at Rosabelle's Ball that evening in the Merrick. It was a fundraiser for Rosabelle's Room, a charity that was set up to help families bereaved by child loss. Rosabelle herself died unexpectedly at 16 months, and the charity was set up by my good friends Suzanne McLean and Gary Munro, her parents. And while they're still brokenhearted, and they always will be, to turn the pain that they went through into something positive, they have helped so many families in similar situations. I mean, it's still absolutely devastating, but it's incredible to see. And it was amazing on Saturday to see people come together to raise money for such a great cause. Now, I have convinced Suzanne, she's well up for spreading the story of Rosabelle's memory and the charity, and she is going to join me on the show at some stage. She has a 7-week-old baby, a 7-year-old son, all the charity work, but we are going to make it happen because it is one I would absolutely love you to hear. It was World Mental Health Day on Thursday, with some incredible events taking place across Ireland and globally. And you'd have to feel like we are getting somewhere. We're much more open about the struggles that people can face, and the message I hope gets through most is that you can get better. And I do think that is getting through. And my guest later that I mentioned, Gary Cunningham, is incredible on that very topic. Now, finally, I have a confession to make, which may sound even worse when I talk about the importance of mental health. But the promise that I made after interviewing Dermot Whelan 3 weeks back about meditating every day for 20 minutes to see if it made a difference to how I feel, I actually haven't even done it once. It's one of those things where not only have I let you down, but I feel I have let myself down. But it's just not something that I can do. And I wanted to announce the book that we're going to be reading on the show as part of Well Read, the Alive and Kicking book club. Now, our first one, you'll remember, was Chicken Soup for the Soul. And our reviewers, Andrea Hayes and David Gillick, came on and reviewed it. Well, our next book has been chosen, and it's The Universe Has Your Back by Gabriella Bernstein. I'd love you to read along, and in about 3 weeks' time or so, we're going to review it on the show. But I've started the book, and I feel it's the same as how I feel about the meditating. All this looking inward, I actually have a bit of an aversion to it. Part of me feels like you have to assume that there's something wrong and that it needs to go in and be fixed. And I don't really like, it's like the car. I don't really go meddling under the hood of the car because chances are it'll be dangerous for me to drive that car after then. I feel quite happy as I am tootling along. And I don't know, it's meditating and all of that. But the fact remains, I haven't done it yet. I am heading away for a few days next week, so maybe I'll use that as a kickstart. And I do feel better now that I've confessed. But will I repent? It remains to be seen. You can email the show. I'd love to hear your thoughts on meditation and looking inward. aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Flu season is upon us, and you can't turn around without someone either claiming they have some sort of virus. And vaccinations are obviously very much being discussed. But what about for those for which viruses are a bigger part of their life? In fact, it's their job. Well, Dr. Kim Roberts is Assistant Professor of Virology and leader of the Influenza Research Group at Trinity College Dublin. And she joins me in studio now. Hello, Kim.
Hello.
So, Kim, how does one begin working in an area like this?
I'm one of those strange geeks who fell in love with viruses at a young age. So I watched a documentary about the terrible 1918 influenza pandemic when I was about 13, 14. and was just hooked. The idea that something so tiny could wreak such havoc on the whole world, cause such devastation, so many deaths, got me fascinated.
So what's the difference between the flu then and now?
That was a really special virus, in a horrible sense. So there were some unique factors in that virus that made it much more dangerous, much more likely to cause severe disease. What we usually deal with every season, every winter, are not that bad, but it's still a serious infection. So we sometimes confuse when we have symptoms between getting a common cold, which is a much more mild virus, to flu, which is more serious and will land you in bed for 5 to 7 days, maybe up to 10 days. And for some people who are in at-risk groups, can lead to very severe complications.
So what's going on in the body when you have a virus like the flu?
So influenza is transmitted through droplets in the air. So when somebody's infected and they're breathing, just talking, you don't need to be coughing and sneezing, they're releasing virus particles. Then the person that they're chatting with breathes in those particles, and the virus binds to the cells in our upper respiratory tract, so in our nose and in our throat, and then starts to replicate. And a lot of the symptoms, certainly the early symptoms that we get when we're infected with flu, are actually our body responding to that virus, trying to control it, trying to shut it down. So when we get those headaches and the achy limbs and we're feeling really, really tired, that's actually our body working really hard to stop the virus from replicating.
So what is the best way to treat a virus then?
So flu is difficult to treat specifically. If you get the flu, the best thing is to rest, stay in bed, drink lots of fluids, and look after yourself. The problem with flu is that we're transmitting the virus before we know we're sick. So about a day to a day and a half before we get any symptoms, we're breathing out these virus particles and transmitting them to our nearest and dearest. So it's a really hard virus to contain. The best way to prevent the spread of the virus is by getting the vaccine. The vaccine is now widely available, and it's not perfect, but it's a pretty good way of preventing getting infected with those seasonal strains of flu, and preventing spreading those viruses to other people. So getting the vaccine is a really good way of preventing being ill. The other good way is really good hand hygiene. So washing your hands, preferably with soap and water. Soap and water tends to destroy the virus better than those alcohol hand sanitizers, but they work as well. So coughing into your elbow rather than coughing into your hands, sneezing into a tissue and then disposing of the tissue, those are all great ways of trying to contain the virus, washing your hands frequently, not touching your mouth and your nose and potentially self-infecting yourself. Those are ways of preventing getting infected. And then once you're sick, best way is to rest.
And stay away from other people. I mean, is it a very normal thing for us to have viruses and for there to be bacteria around and to challenge our body to fight them off?
Absolutely. We're exposed to viruses all the time. Viruses are all around us. And just because somebody is breathing out virus doesn't mean you're going to get sick, because maybe you've had that virus the year before. And so your body has antibodies. Your body has a great immune response to that virus and can fight it off before you notice. But if the virus has changed from the previous year, which is what happens with influenza virus, if you get exposed to that virus, it only takes about 3 or 4 virus particles to get through all of your barriers and infect those cells to cause and trigger an infection. So you really only need a couple of virus particles. It's a pretty crafty virus.
But looking at the research, I mean, it's only half of people that get the vaccine, and usually that's the more vulnerable, the elderly. But you're sort of saying that everybody should get it, whereas a lot of people, myself included, are thinking, oh, sure, it's only the flu. What's the worst that can happen? A week in bed watching Netflix, I'll do it. But I suppose we have to think about the spread of the virus also, do we?
Absolutely. So the vaccine's been around for over 60 years. It's a really, really safe vaccine. And previously, the limitation was on the number of doses that could be generated. And so the people targeted in vaccine campaigns were those at most at risk. So those people who were at risk of severe complications if they get the flu. Then the people targeted are healthcare workers. So anybody who is exposed to lots and lots of people, especially sick people, they're encouraged to get the vaccine as well. Because as I said, you can be transmitting the virus before you know you're sick. So if you're a healthcare worker, you can be passing on that virus to your vulnerable patients without even realizing it. But now we have access to many more doses of the vaccine. And it's easy to obtain the vaccine. You don't have to go see your GP. You can just go to a pharmacy and make an appointment. So there are lots of pharmacies around the country, including, I mean, Boots. They have lots of their pharmacies are offering this service as well. And so you just make an appointment. It's 20 minutes. It's 20 euro for most people. And you can protect yourself and you can protect those people around you who may be more vulnerable to a severe infection.
Are there any side effects? I mean, are you going to feel unwell? What's happening in your body when you get the vaccine? I mean, is it true? Are you getting a little part of the virus so that you can build up the antibodies?
That's a really good question. And it's a bit of a myth that some people think that if you get the flu vaccine, you could get the flu. The vaccine doesn't contain any live virus. So the only thing that's in the vaccine are some little bits of the virus, but that virus cannot replicate in you. However, you're stimulating that immune response. So when you get injected with the vaccine, you might feel sore on your arm at the site of the location for a day or so. It might feel a bit red. And you might have very, very mild symptoms, a little bit of a headache, feeling a little bit off. But those symptoms should go within a few hours, within a few days. And those symptoms are your body responding to that vaccine as that vaccine teaches your immune response how to generate those antibodies that can then protect you.
And can the one vaccine protect you against all the strains? And you mentioned that the influenza strain changes from year to year. So how do you know you're going to be protected against them all?
So there are four strains of influenza virus that are circulating, and the vaccine this year covers all four of those types. So so that one vaccine should protect you from the viruses that are circulating. Now, flu changes, it mutates pretty quickly. So every year the vaccine has to be updated. So if you had the vaccine last year, it probably won't protect you from the virus this year. So you need to have the vaccine every single year. Two of the virus strains that are used to make the vaccine have changed this year compared to last year. So it's really worth getting the vaccine every year.
What about then the other flus? Swine flu, I mean, that changed how I wash my hands forevermore. Avian flu wasn't going around for a little while. We hear of superbugs like MRSA. And sometimes you get the idea that the viruses are growing. I don't know whether it's Hollywood movies that do it, and that eventually they'll grow and wipe us all out. So where are we at in the reality of that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So one of the things to bear in mind with influenza virus is there are loads of them. And we're not actually the natural hosts for influenza viruses. The natural host for influenza viruses, all the different many subtypes, are aquatic birds, so ducks. But then the virus has to mutate pretty significantly. It has to pick up loads and loads of mutations in order to jump across into people. And that's where we think about avian flu. And this doesn't really happen over here, but it often can happen in parts of Asia and parts of China, where we can become aware of people who are infected with avian influenza viruses. Sometimes the virus can mutate and change from other animal species, such as 2009 and the swine flu virus, which crossed over from the pigs into people. Again, those viruses have to pick up mutations. It's pretty rare for that to happen. But then when they do jump into people, we've not seen that virus before. We don't have any immune response to that virus. And it leads to a pandemic, which is when the virus spreads very rapidly around the world. Those pandemics are pretty rare. The last one, as I say, was in 2009. But they're always on the radar, and there are scientists who spend their working lives monitoring these viruses, keeping track of these viruses, and trying to predict where the risks are going to come from. It's a difficult job, trying to predict these random things, but that's what a lot of people do.
You missed an opportunity there to say, but somebody's got to do it. That was your line, Kim. Well, thank God for geeks. And I only use that term because you did. Thank you very, very much for talking to us. That is Dr. Kim Roberts, Assistant Professor of Virology and leader of the Influenza Research Group at Trinity College Dublin.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the baby sleep guru Lucy Wolfe on how she came to be a baby whisperer.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
So ask anyone what they fear most about having a baby, and among other things, number one on the list will probably be sleep deprivation. We love and need our sleep, and so do the amazing little people in our lives. So why is Lucy Wolfe, one of the busiest women in the country, helping family get their Z's back? Well, the author and sleep consultant joins me in studio now. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
Now, Lucy, people are going to be gagging to hear all of your tips, and we will get to those. But how did you get into this? I'm always fascinated to know how you ended up working in this area.
I know. Well, I always say I had a calling from the land of sleep deprivation, because I had a completely different career, and we had our first child, and he originally was a really good sleeper.
What had you been working as?
I was charge surveyor. Auctioneer,
wow.
Charge surveyor.
Completely different.
Yeah, completely different. Yeah, I had my own practice, lectured in my field, loved it. And then we had our first child. He's 17 now. And he was actually a beautiful sleeper. He was a lovely sleeper. He was a lovely little breastfeeder. He latched on straight away. And he was just, he was brilliant. And I didn't know this could happen. But the sleep fell apart when he was probably about 8 or 9 months old. He just suddenly stopped sleeping. And I had just returned to work and I couldn't believe it. And so as a result of that, I was reading books and I was looking for a solution. And in some of the books, they would mention sleep consultants. And so I went to my GP and I said, I need to be referred. And she said, there's nothing here of that nature. So I couldn't believe that then. And then I went on to have another child and she's now nearly 15. And she was a totally different sleeper to Jessie, and still there was no resources. And then friends and started to have babies. My family members were having children and people. It just seemed to be that there was this problem and absolutely no resource for it.
And even in those days, I mean, I don't like to speak of it like the olden days, but there wasn't all the online.
I said that because my son turned 17 recently and I just said, we had dial-up internet. We didn't even send a text when he was born because nobody really sent them.
And nobody really knew what to look up on the internet. We'd be looking up absolute crap. Whereas now you can get YouTube videos, tutorials, you can get
and
stuck into all sorts.
And that comes with its own set of problems. But then I think there was only one website, it was Mumsnet in the UK, and it took about 20 minutes to just dial into the actual system. And
then you've conflicting opinions, haven't you?
You do, and I suppose that's of the era of Gina Ford, and the methods were to cry it out and controlled crying. And I suppose for me as a parent, it didn't sit very well with me. Now, we sorted out our issues, but I suppose what I discovered was that I felt that there was a need, and I actually thought I could become that person that I needed at the time. If that makes any sense.
And it just kept cropping up again
and
again.
Just kept coming up for me, and I suppose I filed it away. And then we had a third baby, but by the time she was due, I was already on my little mission. And we have 4 children now.
So you're highly qualified. I mean, you've trained in UCC, you've gone to the States.
Yeah.
And what comes up time and time again, you continue to upskill and stay on top of the latest research. But you said yourself, even between your own children, they're all different and have different issues.
That's it, exactly. And I suppose the beautiful thing I think for me is that, yes, I have trained, I retrained, and I continue to do so and to stay up to date with current research. But I think now, because I have a practice for nearly 10 years, it's evidence-based, it's practice-based evidence with evidence-based. Does that make any sense to you? So I suppose even the stuff that we were mentored in when I began, and then I see various different things happening with families that I work with. I see different things in my own family unit. And I suppose I feel that it's a craft. I consider it to be that. And I suppose I love the relationship that I develop with a family.
as we work together, because they come to me at quite a vulnerable point in time.
It's a crazy time, because bringing a new baby into the house, everything tips upside down, because it's like nothing you've ever done before and everything is on its head. And it's an amazing time and it's a great time, but it's mad. And people come to you when they're at their wits' end. So what's it like to go into a house like that and be responsible for trying to fix it?
Yeah, well, I suppose I consider it to be a very privileged position, first of all, that I am the person that they put their trust in. Right. Now, I don't go into their homes. Everything I do is a consultation basis. So I'm based in Cork, so they can come to my practice in Cork, or I do it remotely through Skype, video conference call, phone. And we have equal success either way. And I guess I only work with the parent. I never work with the child. I help the parent, and we develop a plan that will start to help them move into what I describe as being a more growthful sleep space. Because for me, it's not necessarily about, let's say, the holy grail of sleeping through. Okay, and again, even those terms, let's just say nobody does that. But what we generally are looking for is for our baby and child, when their age, when it's age relevant, when it's developmentally appropriate, for them to do better, more consolidated, deeper, more restful sleep. And then that has a knock-on positive effect for the whole family unit.
I heard a podcast recently of a couple in the UK. It's called Maybe Baby. I'd recommend it to anybody. She doesn't want kids, she doesn't think, and he does. So they're having a series of interviews to see if it helps them make their ultimate decision in the end. And I heard the comedian Russell Kane suggest that before even contraception stops, that couples sit down and discuss, what way do they want their baby to sleep? What way do they want their baby to be fed? How are the mom and dad going to share these responsibilities? And it blew my mind, because I don't think we think about it enough until we're down, you know, what creek. Yeah,
totally. And I guess we didn't sit down and say what kind of parents we're going to be. And I think ultimately, as parents, we evolve.
Exactly. It can change.
And I completely changed my mindset from number one to number four, and I continue to. And I think that's lovely. But I guess because it's a relationship, it's a partnership in general, and there becomes more people into this partnership, I do think it's important that we have an idea of our philosophies and our ideals. But I also think that, and I say this all of the time, the baby then dictates the terms, because you don't know what kind of baby you're going to get. And I guess it is great to be informed. And I love the idea that parents, before they have their babies, would become really informed where sleep is concerned. Because lots of the challenges that people encounter could be avoided, but only if we have more information in front of us in advance.
And I do think it's great. I mean, we used a sleep consultant as well for a few phone calls. She was somebody we used to have on a radio show I worked on. And to be on the same page with something, because we'd say Lucy says or whatever that the person was, and you're both sticking to that plan because you have somebody who's informed and educated, has told you what to do.
Yeah.
And that's just what you don't have as
a
new parent.
Exactly. And I do think that that makes a huge difference. And I always say, look, I'm just an objective third party. We're going to do this in a collaborative way, but ultimately I'm going to just try and help you make those decisions that between you find it difficult to make, or that you can't make on the landing at 3 o'clock in the morning when the alarm is going to go off in 3 or 4 hours time for everyone to go to work. So yes, it's, I guess for me, it's about accompanying the parent on the journey as they accompany their child on the journey towards this better sleep place. And I suppose I feel very passionate that it's done in a very considered, gentle way, with complete respect to everybody's needs, but especially the child's emotional well-being.
And you spoke about the holy grail of sleeping through the night and mentioned that kids have to be developmentally ready for that. I mean, a newborn needs to be fed through the night. They're just not going to do it. But why do we bandy that term around so much and say mine sleeps 7 to 7, and then the mother or father who doesn't have that is kind of rocking in the corner?
Yeah, and I think that I'm always trying to reframe our language around our expectations, because somewhere, somehow, that it was, there's an expectation and certain bullets, as in they say by 12 weeks your baby should sleep through the night, by 14 pounds your baby is able to sleep through the night, and these things, they're not accurate, and I think they undermine us. It's a bit like I always talk about the 2 hour nap, because I think it's a unicorn. You know, there are very few or very rare mythical characters, 2 hour naps, yet parents spend a lot of their days trying to get a 2 hour nap. And someone might say to me, it was not a good nap, or he only does about an hour. I'm like, that's a great nap. That's an amazing nap, because we have to put things into perspective. And so I suppose, yes, I think it's important that we have that understanding. Young babies, specifically infant babies, they're not supposed to sleep very well. Waking keeps them alive.
Yeah.
Okay. And I suppose we need to understand that they're going to wake and feed frequently. and they're going to have absolutely no respect for our nighttime sleep. And this is where partnership comes in, support comes in, that in that early few months where sleep is difficult and where the needs of the baby are really high. So lots of babies come with a really high need to be held and rocked, and they don't want to sleep on their own laying down. And this is the tricky time. That's not a problem. It feels like a problem, but it isn't. It's just typical infant sleep. And what we need to do is we need to try and figure out, how do we work through this and then start to make subtle changes that support better sleep to come.
So when should a routine start? Because I remember battling with that myself, trying to put a newborn down and get them used to settling without me. And when I look back at photos, I'm like, why did I not just let them sleep on top of me every single second I had the opportunity?
Yeah. And if I met you, I would have said to you, just lean into it, Claire. Just lean into it. Hold them, rock them, roll them. Do what they need, lean into their need. I talk to parents about, in those early few months, building what I call the loving trust bond, because they just come out earthside. They're completely dependent on you. They need to know that you're going to respond to their every need. They need to have a level of confidence in you, and they need to be able to trust you. And I suppose they need to feel loved. And I think that's our priority. And then you can work behind the scenes. Because, again, I don't even like the word routine. Now, I know it's semantics, but I talk to families about a feeding and sleeping balance. Because I think that's less, you know, there's no rigid connotations there, because it shouldn't be. It should be cue-based, really. We should absolutely have some certain markers, because the circadian rhythm makes up a big part of sleep challenges. The internal body clock. And that's from the moment your child is born. It's there, it's not mature, it won't be till they're gone four, but it has such a huge influence on your child's sleep, which is why the idea of a routine becomes important. And basically just it means you have a regular wake time, that you have regular napping structures throughout the course of the day, but in line with your baby's need. So they're going to tell you what they need, but we need to learn the language of sleep.
And what if your toddler is telling you they need to sleep in the bed with you every night?
Yeah, there's a behavioural component to sleep. So it's kind of driven by two major forces. Everything affects the sleep, like absolutely everything. And when I say that, I mean like everything your baby thinks and feels, sees, does, eats and drinks affects their sleep. But also everything you think and feel, see and do, and for breastfeeding mums, eat and drink affects your child's sleep. Okay, and so that's a lot of force factors. But then there's these two major contributory factors. One is the biological timekeeping, which boils down to being overtired a lot of the time. And the other is association and ability. So association might be that from early on they came into the bed and that's perfect. But unless you tell them that's not what we do here, they actually don't know, because the association is there that bed sharing is what we do. So if I interviewed your 2.5-year-old or 3-year-old who routinely comes into the bed and said, where do you sleep? He would show me your bedroom, because that's all he knows. So again, it's about those decisions, and they can be made at any stage. They don't need to be made the day you plan to conceive, right? You can make these decisions as you go along. I bed shared with my children. My last guy, I bed shared with him for a long time.
The 17-year-old?
No, the last fellow.
He's not still there.
No, there's not the 17-year-old, because he'll kill me now. No, the last guy who's nearly nine. I knew he was the last.
He was your last one.
Yeah, I knew it as well. But the point is this: you need to make an informed decision that suits your little family unit.
Yeah, and if it's not an issue in your family, then that's absolutely fine.
But then if it does start, and this is where I come in, if it starts to become a problem or a challenge within the household, it's causing certain areas of tension, then we look to maybe reversing, improving, enhancing and changing the associations. And that can be done in a really considerate way. Doesn't have to be thinking of controlled crying or cry it out, because there's lovely ways of improving your child's sleep.
Amazing. Well, I think that's why you're so good at your job, because you have the empathy, because you've been through it yourself, not only with other families, but in your own. And you have all the education and qualifications to back it up. You can find out more at sleepmatters.ie. Will you come back and do a Q&A with us one of these days?
Of course, I'd love to.
I don't know. We could do a whole show. Thank you very, very much, Lucy Wolfe.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Coming up, Gary Cunningham on how 3 years in prison helped him to get his negative thought patterns in check and realise he is good enough, and why he's sharing all this in his latest book.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at repromed.ie.
Gary Cunningham rose to prominence in his book Joy of Joys, Finding Myself in Mountjoy Prison, and subsequently Life After Joy, A Prisoner No More. Gary was sentenced to 3.5 years for drug possession, and he used his time in prison to work on himself, and he found a new love for words, music, mental and physical well-being and their importance. He today volunteers in prisons and schools and has been encouraged from his time with inmates and young people who just seem to have a sense that they aren't good enough for anything to write his latest book, I Am Enough. And he joins me in studio now. Hello, Gary.
How are you doing? It's such a pleasure to be here. I've literally just started following you on Instagram, and you never think that the voyeur in us is so interested in somebody buttering a slice of bread or opening a door. And yeah, I was enthralled by all you do. So I'm quite fangirlish sitting here at the moment. And I decided to keep all this to myself till we were live. So I could then put you on the spot and make you feel awkward.
I try not to share too much.
No, you're great.
Because you kind of feel like you're overburdening people.
Some people are like, literally, if you go back to the old kind of way Facebook used to be, it's like, I'm on the toilet, you know. I've just flushed the toilet, you know, who cares?
But then I find myself looking at people cleaning houses and cleaning ovens and setting up apartments, and you know, sometimes the banal is very interesting.
Do you know, it actually inspired a chapter in this book that I've entitled On Social Media, for the very reason that I feel we only see a snapshot of someone's life. I think what's great about someone like yourself who works on TV and radio is that you give a very honest account. But if we're being really honest, and what I try to say to especially to young ladies as well, is you see someone going out on a Saturday night, we never see them on the Sunday morning, you know.
Yeah.
We don't see them on the Tuesday when the fear is there, you know. And I'm always trying to say that's just literally 5 seconds of somebody's life, you know. Because
yeah, it's the highlight reel, isn't it?
You don't see the low light. I personally, I put one post up a week in social media. I keep it on a Monday. I keep it positive. But I've been known to go on and have an old rant.
Yeah.
Say, I'm not feeling good today, because I think that's important.
Well, know? That has really helped me, because we do strive for perfection. And I want to talk to you about that a little bit, because we've been sold this mentality as well that we can be whatever we want to be if we really put our mind to it. Mm-hmm. And I really live a lot by that.
So do I.
And I think that's a really good thing as well. But I remember reading an article by a guy, and he said to be mediocre is fine. And it really tugged at everything that I believe in. And yet what he was saying was true, and maybe that's what leads people to think they're not good enough.
They're not good enough. I'm like, people say I'm quite a positive guy. I am. I have my down days like everybody else. I have a teacher. I have a guy, quick plug, called at Miller's Avengers on Twitter or on Instagram. I highly recommend you follow this guy. He's a very good friend of Claire's. And he teaches me a lot. He said this to me one day. He said, money can't buy you happiness, but poverty can't buy you anything. He just seeks out the truth. And he's been really helping me to realise this, because I'm abandoning this message, I'm enough, but can I be really honest with you? Sometimes I don't feel good enough for anything. I don't feel good enough to get out of bed. I have a story. I don't really feel the necessity maybe to talk about that now. There's people that are home listening, my family, that don't need to hear it again. But I had one person who maybe should have loved me and cared for me and didn't. And I got some mental abuse, and I was made feel not good enough. But what I try and teach when I go into the schools is that I chose to believe someone else's opinion of me. And I actually lived. And I suppose, Claire, if you don't mind me saying, if I decided, now I'd probably be arrested on the way out, but if I decided for the rest of the interview just to refer to you as Miss Stupid, if I just did it for the whole interview, you know you're not stupid. I know you're not stupid.
Yeah, but after
the
a
end
while,
of it,
you
just kind of say, why is he saying that all the time? Well, I had 20 odd years of that. So it's not an excuse for why I ended up where I ended up, but it's given me this kind of a slight insight into maybe what's going on today, you know, with not feeling good enough about yourself.
And speaking of the schools, you've been blown away by the feedback you've been getting from people, and it's quite bleak to see so many young people disillusioned.
What actually started out as I went into prisons, and I was on the Late Late Show. It was amazing. It was the night after my first book was launched, and it was quite a moving night. I cried in front of, it was the most viewed thing on Irish Telly that night, quite proud of that. It was 550,000 people watching, and I bawled my lamps out. Because he started talking about my mum. My mum's, I'll probably start crying now. I cry all the time, Claire, and I'm quite proud of that. He started talking about my mum, and I cried. And what happened was the Irish Prison Service kind of got in touch, and I started going into prisons. And I'm a very, very unorthodox way. Like, you have me totally, totally politically correct today. I use bad language all the time. I'm Gary. I'm not trying to be someone I'm not. I just say who I am, but I'm very aware of where I am, so don't worry, please. And I remember one talk I gave in Portlaoise Prison. It was quite moving, actually. It was a great day. But the governor actually approached me and said he was in the room. She was in the room for the whole day. And she said, that was powerful. That was incredible. And I said, yeah, but I feel like I'm a little bit late. And she said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, these are already in prison. I said, I'm trying to teach them to own their stuff when they get out. You know, don't start looking for excuses, or society won't accept you. But I'd love to prevent people from going to prison. So what started out, asking you shall receive. I'm very much a believer in the law of attraction. And I asked, and I received. I stood on the stage in the stall in front of 900 students the first time I ever did it. And I took 900 selfies that day. I had 900 kids telling me something. My mum witnessed that whole thing. It was from Reuters Week, and Mary, who ran Reuters Week, walked up to my mum and said, "We've never seen anything like this before." And I'm telling you this because I probably use bad language, and they relate to me.
Yeah, yeah.
They relate to
you
me.
Weren't lecturing no, to them, you were just talking to them.
Thank you so much, Claire. That's what I say all the time. I have so much admiration for the teachers in this country that they go in every day and teach our children. But they have a curriculum that they need to drive home, so they need to lecture. So if I'm going to go into your child's school, I don't want to lecture them. I want them to listen to me. So I jump on the desks, I shout, I scream, I laugh, I do what I can. But what started out as literally, I won't do it now, I can remove these two teeth because I had them punched when I walked into Mountjoy. I got my teeth knocked out. I deserved every bit of it. Every single bit of it I deserved because I walked in there with an absolutely disgusting attitude, thinking I was something I was not. And I got some manners put on me. And nothing ever happened to me in Mountjoy after that because I copped on. I got my head together. I had to find that I was enough in Mountjoy, and that was one of the most difficult journeys I've ever been on.
And do you think, in a way, it feels strange to say you were lucky to have the time
it
in prison?
It saved my life.
But you didn't have the... A lot of the time, we don't work on ourselves because we're so busy in this busy life.
I was busy being an alcoholic, though, and I was busy being a narcissist, and I was busy being a very, very disgusting human being. And I think that's quite important to say that. I was busy in work. I was a painter and decorator, but everything I did was to self-serve me. I absolutely made an abomination of being a father. I completely messed that up. I'm just hoping in time that I can rectify that. And I mean, I have to allow that particular person to go on their own journey, but I have to live with that. That's a very important point with this book. I'm no expert. I am by far not an expert. In fact, when it comes to being a parent, I failed miserably.
But you can see where your mistakes were along the line, or where the holes were.
Definitely.
And that's what you're trying
to
share with people.
But what happened, Claire, about me trying to scare these young people into don't take drugs, don't go to prison, they related to me. And I think the first one I got was a young lad. And I won't tell you where it was. He was 17 years of age. And he said, "Can I speak to you on your own?" And I said, "Certainly." And he said he had been bullied at home. It's a really, really sad story. His dad was giving him a hard time and this, that and the other. And he just said, "The way you spoke about your situation." So we spoke for a while. And then I started noticing every school I went to, I was hearing something really, really sad. And the common denominator was, I'm not good enough. I was like, wow, I'm actually getting quite upset now thinking about this. And a lot from young girls that they're not good enough. And I just got really annoyed. So I started thinking with my partner at home, Antoinette. I started saying, I need a catch. I need like a phrase. And like, I didn't invent these words. I'm enough. And what I did initially was I'd jump on the desks. I'm in a principal walked in one day and she literally thought a lunatic had walked into her school. I was on top of the desk screaming at them, these kids in Edwardstown. I said, what have you to say? And they're all shouting, "I'm enough," and it's great when you're a dub. And I said, "Ah, the dubs are much louder than you." And so we had that moment. But unfortunately, it came to a school in Rackhill, County Dublin. I was really, really honing my talks at this stage. So I was actually moving away. I tell my story, but then I was moving away from that. And I do all the positive mental health, but let's forget all the buzzwords, you know. At Miller's Adventures, like, you know, just get to the truth. That's what he'd tell you, just get to the truth. So it's okay not to be okay, of course it is, but these kids are hearing so much that it can become diluted a little bit. So let's understand what that means. Let's break that down a little bit. And we'd have some great fun and everything was good. But this one particular day, I had 3rd years, 4th years, 5th years and 6th years all in the one room. And I started becoming a bit of a ninja. By the way, ninja is what I call everybody. What's a ninja? The coolest person in the world.
Coolest person
in the world. So, I was starting to become a ninja insofar as that's a wine jumper, they're younger, that's a darker jumper, they're older. And of course, 3 girls approached me from this side. And I'm just going to refer to the young girl as Kay. She approached and she had her 2 little bodyguards either side and they were feckin' sobbing. And Kay started off by saying, "Thank you so much for telling me I'm enough. Sorry, I really needed to hear that today. And I'm learning not to anger somebody's grief, so usually I'm a hugger." And I just kind of stepped back and I said, "Stop, you are more than enough." And her friend is ribbing her, just hitting her in the ribs and saying, just tell him what the story is. And she said, "We're so sorry, it's just our best friend took his own life 2 weeks ago." The girl that was standing in front of me was 13 years of age. And I was so rude, I turned and I looked at her teacher, I ignored her, and in a really fingerless way said, "How old is she?" And her teacher was quite upset, you know, she's like, "She's 14, Gary. I'm sorry, but I couldn't spell suicide when I was 13, and I certainly didn't know anybody my age, or probably older, I'm not sure, who had taken their own life. And yet today, we don't, it's still shocking. It's not as shocking as it should be. It's becoming almost normalised, and it's really scary. And I honestly feel, personally, as a society, we really need to look when we have 12 and 13-year-old boys and girls feeling that it's so bleak that they need to end it all.
Now, I've looked into this myself because it's an area that really fascinates me, and I mean that in the empathetic sense of the word. I don't understand why any 12-year-old would think that they are better off not on this earth.
Yeah.
And it's a documentary I've wanted to make for a long time.
Yeah.
And what has come back to me from experts time and time again is what you're saying. It's resilience.
Massively.
It's teaching young people
massively
that you're going to have trouble. It's a very normal part of life, but you need the skills to move on from the tough times. And that's what you're aiming to teach. What are the tips that you give?
Okay, so the book deals with the most common thing. I wanted it cheap. So I wanted it to be as cheap as possible. I wanted it to be quick because they know I've got their backs, every student. So they know I'm cool when I say this. So I'm sick of this statement that I'm only little so-and-sos, right? So usually I'd say, you are, aren't you? And they say, yeah, we are. Mm. But my thing, and I think you're going to agree with this, is why? Just today, why? We didn't have to deal with this absolute crap that social media when we were in our teens. And you know, social media, and I've just put up a little thing where I'm in news, like, yay, and it's great. But the toxic side of social media is unbelievable. So I decided to listen when I asked. I put my phone away. I opened my heart. I had clarity of the mind. And if I said to a student, how are you today? I just shut up for a minute. I shut everything off and I listened. And that's when I got really sad, to be quite honest with you. So these are, like, literally I picked 10, 9 subjects that I could have gone 99. That's the sad thing. But you've got the most prevalent, which would be bullying, consent, alcohol, drugs, losing somebody, which is massive. We don't really, a granddad, a grandparent, that it really affects us as adults, but sometimes that teen, we have such a close relationship with their nanny and their granddad, they can't understand death. And then unfortunately, chapter 9 it was one of the most horrific things I've ever done. It's called No One Understands, and it's about a young lady who has decided to take her own life. But she, very Hollywood, I know, but the night before she writes her letter for her folks, the next morning her auntie's in the house screaming, crying that somebody had just taken their own life, and she gets to see a funeral and she gets to see the devastation. I really want to share something with you, and I am going to cry. I got an Instagram message yesterday evening from a young boy who's just finished a book, and I know him from a school talk. He cycled out the Hoth with the idea of jumping off the pier. He's only 16. And he remembered what I said to him. And when he was sitting there, he rang the Samaritans, and thank God they did whatever they did. He was brought home. His message on Instagram, I'll show you when we go, said, oh my God, chapter 9. He said, the last page of chapter 9 is filled with my tears. He said, but I went down to my mum and I apologised, and I was completely mind blown by that. So the certain bookshops aren't jumping on this at the moment, which, you know, I'm not David Walliams and I'm coming up to Christmas. I don't care. After that message last night, I actually don't care, because I'm the richest man in the world today, if that's what that did, you know.
How do you keep yourself strong through all of this? Because it's a massive responsibility.
I'm surrounded by absolute ninjas. So my partner, Antoinette, is just, I don't know how she puts up with me, but I met her in prison. It's a very funny story, actually, but she knows me. She's amazing. Anthony Miller, that man, he's amazing. Claire, who you had sitting here.
Claire McGrath
is
bodybuilding superwoman.
Everything. I mean, but so beautiful and so graceful and so helpful. She just literally sent me a message last night that just said, I love you, Gary. Nothing else, nothing more. I love you, Gary. So I have these people that really care about me, and they came and seen some of my talks where they can be chaotic sometimes. I've been abused. I know all that. But I also abused, insofar as I abused alcohol, I abused life. I've worn that T-shirt of being an absolute.
Yeah, but you need to walk the walk to talk the talk, and you certainly do. Gary, I hope people pick up this book. It's called I Am Enough, Words to Live By Gary Cunningham. Get it, have it in your house, read it yourself. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
So that's it from Alive and Kicking this week. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy, researcher Elaine Power, and Jojo Cordoza was on sound. Vincent Wall is up next. Have a great Sunday.